From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, looking to resolve the Yemen crisis. Australia and Turkey hope to stop a flow of militants to Syria. Should the EU copy Australia's policy on migration? And a United Arab Emirates rights advocate is up for a prestigious award.
He's been jailed for his effort. His websites have been shut down, and he's currently subject to a travel ban because of his activities.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Airstrikes by a Saudi-led coalition in Yemen continue, even though Riyadh had announced it was ending its month-long bombing campaign against Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Saudi Arabia said it would stop the bombing and shift its focus to a political solution that would include a resumption of United Nations-led peace talks. The United States welcomed an end to the bombing campaign and urged all warring parties to return to the negotiating table. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Gregory Gause, head of the International Affairs Department at Texas A&M University, about possible outcomes in Yemen and U.S. options there.
I think that the only way out of this conflict, as it stands now, is a return to negotiations, because it doesn't seem to me that either side can win militarily. The Houthis apparently can't win without air cover, and the Saudis can't win, and their supporters in Yemen can't win without more ground troops. And that doesn't seem to be coming for either side. I think that we might be hitting a stalemate.
With the ground option receding after Pakistan turned down a Saudi request to send troops, and Egypt seems in no rush to send soldiers into Yemen, what are the other possible scenarios in Yemen?
I think that it's unlikely that we're going to get a political solution that stabilizes Yemen, and I think it's unlikely that we're going to get a military victory that's so complete by one side in Yemen that order is restored from the top. I think it's highly likely that what we're going to see in Yemen is a continuation of authority, real authority, devolved down to local groups, Houthis, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, tribal groups, and other armed elements in Yemen. That's not that unusual in Yemen. Yemen has really never had a very strong central government. But I think that what we'll probably see is de facto division of the country, but no official political settlement of the conflict.
But some experts say that the Saudi-led coalition started with no clear political or military objective. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it started with some clear objectives, but an inability to achieve them. I think the clear objective was to drive the Houthis back, if not all the way to Sana'a, perhaps even further up to Sada'a. But that could not be done simply from the air. And I think that it wasn't so much the objectives that weren't clear. I think it was the inability to bring to bear the necessary military power to achieve them. I think that at this point, the best outcome for the Saudis would have to be some kind of negotiation that renews the national dialogue, that brings President Hadi back into Yemen, and that leads to a Houthi withdrawal, at least to Sana'a.
Final question. For the U.S., Yemen presents a breeding ground for terrorists and offers Iran an opportunity to extend its influence as it did before in Lebanon. What are the U.S. options in Yemen?
I don't think the U.S. has many options in Yemen in that I don't think there's much the U.S. can do to try to rebuild some kind of acceptable state authority in Yemen. The U.S. has never been that involved in the internal politics of Yemen. The Saudis have always been the external power that's had the most influence in Yemen. But I think from the point of view of the U.S., Yemen has always been considered as a side issue to larger issues. And I think that the larger issue now is the reassurance of Saudi Arabia and other Arab allies in light of the Lausanne Agreement that the U.S. is not going to abandon them. And I think that's why the United States so strongly supported the Saudi offensive in Yemen.
Gregory Gause, head of the International Affairs Department at Texas A&M University. The International Committee of the Red Cross says the humanitarian situation in Yemen is nothing short of catastrophic. The Red Cross reports since Saudi Arabia launched its air campaign on March 26, violence has escalated and conditions for millions of civilians in Yemen have dramatically deteriorated. Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The head of ICRC operations for the Near and Middle East, Robert Mardini, has just returned from a three-day visit to the capital, Sana'a, and bears witness to the grim reality of life in Yemen. He says the resilience of the Yemeni people has been eroded to the breaking point, and that people are ill-equipped to cope with the current situation and its aftermath.
Nowhere is safe in Yemen today. Nearly a month of death and destruction after years of crisis leaves little hopes for Yemenis to lead a normal life. At least 50 people were killed and 200 wounded every day since 26 March. The recent reports we got from our teams from Aden, Sana'a, Taiz are alarming. Tens of thousands have been displaced and sought shelter in schools and mosques. Hundreds have been arrested.
Mardini describes the damage to property and infrastructure by the airstrikes and ground fighting as absolutely shocking. He says indiscriminate shootings are a constant threat to the entire population. He also says aid workers and ambulances are under attack, noting that three Red Crescent volunteers have been killed and two wounded in the line of duty since March 26th. He says many hospitals are open but lack medicines and medical staff as the number of wounded is rising. He says millions of people are short of basic goods and services. They lack food, water, fuel, and drugs, and this is leading to soaring prices for the most basic commodities. Despite the many hardships and multiple threats facing its staff, Mardini says the ICRC will not be deterred from carrying out its humanitarian operations. He says the Red Cross plans to scale up its activities.
We made the deliberate choice to keep our teams present and operational since 26 March. Going forward, we will pursue our efforts and further reinforce our presence and action. We will continue to act as a neutral intermediary to ensure safe movement of trapped civilians. We will continue our support to hospitals and health structures. We will do more to meet people's need for food and water. We will continue to work with the local water authorities to keep the water flowing and backup power facilities running.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is launching a preliminary $15 million appeal to cover this emergency response. This is in addition to the nearly $29 million it has already budgeted for its operations in Yemen. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australia and Turkey have announced plans to stop the flow of Australians traveling to Syria to fight for Islamic radical groups. During a visit by Prime Minister Tony Abbott to Ankara, the governments say they are working to stop foreign fighters from using Turkey as a transit point. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The focus of the agreement between Australia and Turkey is intelligence sharing. Australia is increasingly worried about the number of its citizens fighting for militant groups in the Middle East, and officials will send information to Turkey about suspected Australian militants. Many have travelled through Turkey to reach conflicts in Iraq and Syria. It's estimated that at least 70 Australians are fighting with the Islamic State group. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu has said his government would detain alleged foreign fighters from Australia and would send them home if requested. His Australian counterpart Tony Abbott is in Turkey ahead of the upcoming Anzac Day commemorations, marking a historic battle pitting Australian and New Zealand troops against the Ottoman Empire in 1915 during World War I. Mr. Abbott says relations between Australia and Turkey have thrived since the conflict at Gallipoli.
This is a relationship that had the worst possible beginning. But from that grim and gruesome beginning, a deep and genuine friendship has grown. I think as a result of that very close cooperation, Australians who wish to go to Syria and Iraq via Turkey will find it increasingly difficult.
In Australia, an Islamic centre linked to two teenagers accused of terrorism-related offences closed down. The Alpha Khan Islamic Center has distanced itself from the men who were arrested during raids last weekend and says it's closing its doors because of insidious campaigns by politicians and the media, leading to harassment and false accusations. Sevdip Basim and Harun Korsevich are accused of planning to carry out an attack on Anzac Day ceremonies. Investigators say the teenagers attended the Al-Furqan Islamic Center. It's alleged the two were associates of an 18-year-old man from Afghanistan who'd also visited the center in Melbourne and was shot dead after stabbing two anti-terrorism officers in Australia last September. Canberra raised the national terror threat level to high for the first time last September when counter-terror raids took place after the police received information that Islamic State supporters planned to carry out a public beheading. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
European Union leaders gathered in Brussels today to take part in an emergency session to find ways to cope with an influx of migrants from the Middle East and Africa who take to the Mediterranean with the help of people traffickers and often overcrowded and unseaworthy boats. The crisis crystallized after a 20-meter-long overloaded vessel capsized early Sunday off Libya's coast, drowning hundreds of people. Some 1,800 have perished at sea so far this year. A draft statement made public Wednesday suggests the EU leaders may consider military action to identify, capture, and destroy vessels. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Renzi is calling for a doubling of resources for the EU Border Patrol mission, better coordination in the handling of asylum seekers, and boosting the presence of UN refugee offices in Africa. EU analyst Ben Wellings of Australia's Monash University tells VOA's Victor Beatty one possible solution may mirror what Australia has been doing for years by diverting thousands of migrants from Southeast and South Asia to Pacific Islands.
Various Pacific Islands, Papua New Guinea, Nauru, more recently Asian nations in point of fact, well, one attempt with Malaysia that was unsuccessful, and then now with Cambodia, which has agreed with the Australian government to house asylum seekers. A way of indicating to traffickers that people will not reach Australia. So this is sort of seen to be attractive. It plays out well, if not contentiously, in domestic politics. It's been an intractable political problem in Australia. The military solution, again, borrows a little bit from the Australian example, and that is the Royal Australian Navy has been deployed to turn back boats that are approaching Australian territorial waters and tow them back into Indonesian territorial waters. Now, you can imagine, of course, there are concerns of issues and sovereignty and bilateral relations that are caused thereby. So it remains to be seen, I mean, whether the Europeans are sort of considering some preemptive strike on the boats of human traffickers remains to be seen. But certainly a kind of a harder response has been run by the Australian government really since 2001. And I think Australian governments, particularly the European governments, particularly the United Kingdom, are looking closely at these.
What is the record of this Australian plan, which, as you indicated, has been going on now for nearly 15 years?
Supporters of the Australian plan say it's effective, it works, the numbers of arrivals in Australia and indeed people setting out from Indonesia to arrive in Australia has dropped. I mean, in some senses, that just pushes the problem back to Indonesia rather than addressing the humanitarian concern. And critics of the policy would say that it's morally empty, it's inhumane, people die in detention centres or have been killed in riots in detention centres and they become very mentally ill. It seems to me that there's truth in both those positions. It's not a solution. It's often billed as a solution, but, you know, it might be called the Pacific solution or the Malaysian solution or the Cambodian solution. But in fact, it doesn't seem to me to be a solution at all. It just seems to defer the problem or push it away from Australia's borders, where it becomes an issue for developing countries. It's been bumping along since 2001 in Australia, and it seems to be a fixed and permanent feature of the political landscape now.
Well, Australia, the United States, and now, of course, the European Union are grappling with this immigration matter. How will this impact the European Union politically? What impact will it have on the individual member states of the EU?
It's an immediate problem for those Mediterranean states, particularly Italy, Malta, Spain, and to a lesser extent, Greece. These are the countries that have a close maritime border to North Africa, and so it means that the jump into EU territory is the shortest. it will put a strain on their ability to deal with these kind of things. Although, you know, the EU has taken a European-level attempt to coordinate here because it does affect the region, it will put a strain on the politics. And if Australia is anything to go by, it will start to act as a divisive mechanism in politics of those individual member states and the EU more broadly, because there'll be two groups of people. One say we need a humanitarian response, we've got to accept these people. Another group will say we need to prevent them from arriving for whatever reason. So I would expect this to become a deepening and more divisive political issue in individual member states and the EU as a whole in the years to come.
More than 200,000 migrants made the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean last year. 3,500 of those perished at sea in their desperate journey to escape poverty, war, and repression. Last year, the EU scrapped a Mediterranean search and rescue program over its cost and concerns it was encouraging more migrants to make the dangerous voyage to Europe. 10 international human rights organizations have selected the three final nominees for the Martin Ennals Award of 2015, and among them is Ahmed Mansour of the United Arab Emirates. Michael Kambata is director of the Martin Ennals Foundation, which gives out the award for human rights defenders. We spoke with him about Mansour's work.
Ahmed Mansour has been working for many years in the Emirates to try and bring human rights issues forward. He works on things like freedom of expression. He's especially involving online communication and expression. He's been jailed for his efforts. His websites have been shut down, and he's currently subject to a travel ban because of his activities, and his passport's expired and has never been renewed. He's widely respected in the international human rights community for providing really unbiased information on arbitrary detention, torture, degrading treatment, failure to meet international standards for fair trials, and so forth.
Have you heard from him?
Yes, I'm in touch with him regularly. I mean, he is free. He's just unable to travel, and of course, all his communications are monitored.
He must be very excited about being one of the final nominees for this prestigious award.
Well, I hope so. He said so, and he's tweeted out that he's very happy to have been selected as one of the three finalists for the Martin Ennals Award.
What is the importance of this award?
The Martin Ennals Award is designed to provide protection to human rights defenders who are in danger or at risk. And what makes it important is it's selected by 10 of the largest human rights organizations in the world. It's Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and 8 others. They each send their senior staffers to help select the organization, to help select the finalists and ultimately the laureate. They invest time and effort in analyzing the various nominations. And basically, this allows it to be really an expression of the human rights community. The award is given out in Geneva. It's given out by the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. It has been for the last 10 years. And we invite all three of them to Geneva and to the ceremony to honor all three of them, even though one of them is named the laureate in October.
And this award is named for a famous human rights activist.
Exactly. Martin Ennals was the man who basically took Amnesty International as a very tiny organization in 1968 and brought it onto the world stage when he left in 1980. There were 200 people working there, and what it said started to have impact around the world. And in fact, many of the people who now work for or started other organizations got their start at Amnesty, which is one of the first international human rights organizations.
Besides the prestige of winning such award, is there any financial benefit?
Yes, there's the prize itself is 20,000 Swiss francs for the laureate and 5,000 for the two finalists. The city of Geneva, which is a partner in running the ceremony, also provide about 12,000 Swiss francs to each of the three nominees. Our main goal, though, is not the financial prize. Our main goal is really the publicity that will allow, that basically provides protection. We've been told year in, year out by our former laureates and finalists how important that is, and they can point to really concrete changes, how they've been safer in their work.
Michael Kambata, director of the Martin Ennals Foundation. The award is to be presented on October 6th. Washington is the center of U.S. political power and also home to some of the nation's most visited museums. One just being built will showcase the Bible. Journalists, including VOA's Jerome Sokolowski, were invited to visit the site of the $400 million museum, which is scheduled to open in 2017.
Museum officials said the history of the Bible will be presented through multimedia exhibits, ancient Torah scrolls, parchments from the New Testament, and other items from the huge private collection of its chairman, Steve Green. An evangelical Christian, he believes in spreading the gospel.
We would hope people would consider what the book has to say, and that's a choice that they make, and if it's compelling, that is a decision that they can make on their own, but we believe it's something that everybody ought to consider.
Green is a key figure in America's culture wars. Last year, his family business won a Supreme Court case against having to pay for his employees' birth control. Reverend Barry Lynn of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State doesn't oppose the museum on constitutional grounds.
There's no question that if you want to build a museum to the Bible, the Quran, any building at all, and someone is willing to sell you the property, you have the right to buy it in this country.
Instead, he sees it as proof that conservative Christians are trying to force government to legislate according to their faith.
I can't believe that the people who created the Bible Museum wanted this to be anywhere but close to the center of power and close to other official government buildings.
Bible Museum President Carrie Summers says that's not true.
The decision was made to be in Washington because of the museums here. It really was not because the Capitol was here.
But the museum will be just two blocks from the National Mall. And the idea of an institution devoted to any religious text will continue to cause concern for Americans who believe in limiting the role of religion in the public square. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
Nilar Sagan, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Security Council has adopted a resolution which seeks to stop the violent takeover of Yemen by the Houthis and bring all parties back to the negotiating table. In recent months, the Houthis seized large swaths of territory in Yemen and forced the elected president, Abdurrabo Mansour Hadi, to flee the country. Security Council Resolution 2216 was adopted on April 14th by a vote of 14-0, with Russia abstaining. It imposes a global asset freeze and travel ban on two key Houthi leaders, as well as a targeted arms embargo on former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, his son, and their supporters. This is in addition to UN sanctions already imposed by the Security Council on former President Saleh and two Houthi commanders last November. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power said the United States strongly supports the Security Council resolution,
which imposes consequences on the Houthi and former President Saleh, demands that the Houthi cease military operations, and calls on all sides to once again return to the negotiating table. The imposition of a global asset freeze and travel ban on Ahmed Ali Saleh and Abdelmalek al-Houthi, as well as a targeted arms embargo, shows that this council will take action against those who continue to undermine efforts toward reconciliation.
Ambassador Power noted that the Security Council resolution recognizes the rapidly deteriorating humanitarian conditions in Yemen and urges all sides to comply with their obligations under international law and facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance to civilians in need. The actions the Houthis have taken threaten the security and the welfare of the Yemeni people and the region, said Ambassador Power. The UN, she said, must continue its efforts to hold talks to find a consensus solution to this crisis, and all parties must commit to taking part in these talks. There is no alternative.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.